It's Lynn Rossetto Casper with The Splendid Table. So does the idea of buying a little farmhouse in France and paying for it with cooking classes appeal? Well, before you do the bank transfer, meet our guest. She's French food authority and cooking school owner, Susan Herman Loomis. Her book is Cooking at Home on Rue Tintin. Well, the Stearns have found a classic Jewish deli a little west of the Hudson, like in San Diego. Then it's the new whole wheat pastas from the New York Times' Marion Burroughs. They're edible. That's revolutionary. The guy who wrote the book on pizza, Ed Levine, taste tests frozen pies. And we meet the chef who's making the food in Kentucky State Parks about Kentucky, not the latest Cisco truck delivery. All this and your calls coming up on The Splendid Table. But first, this.
Red ripe tomatoes, I'm never satisfied. I want the frim-fram sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. I don't want pork chops and bacon that won't awaken my appetite inside. I want the frim-fram sauce with the aus and fade, with shafafa on the side. Well, you know a girl, she really got to eat, and a girl, she should eat right. 5 will get you 10. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said, waiter, please. I want my fried, I want the frim-fram sauce with the awesome fay, with shafafa all on the side. Shoo-doo-dee-doo-ya-doo-doo. Shoo-ba-doo-ya-doo-shay-ya-din-doo. My appetite inside. I want the frim-fram sauce
right. Fire will get you ten. I'm gonna feed myself right tonight. I don't want fish cakes and rye bread. You heard what I said. Waiter, please. I want my mind fried. I want the frim fram sauce with the os and fay with Chef Papa on the side. Ooh, with Chef Papa on the side.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, and you're listening to The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. Our program is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by Super Target. Well, today it's another food lover's dream job. We hear about what it takes to create your own cooking school in France from French food authority and cooking teacher Susan Herman Loomis. Susan's book is Cooking at Home on Rue Tatin. Well, New York Times columnist Marion Burroughs has made an earth-shaking discovery. The new whole wheat pastas are actually edible. In fact, they really taste good. Then it's the best of frozen pizzas, a no-holes-barred tasting by Ed Levine, the guy who's taste-tested pizzas across the country and in Italy for his book Pizza, A Slice of Heaven. We talk with a champion slasher of government red tape, Kentucky chef Bob Perry, who is now doing honest-to-goodness Kentucky-grown food in state parks. And as always in the second half of the show, we're going to be opening the lines for your calls. The number is 800-537-5252. So let's roll with Jane and Michael Stern. They write the Road Food column in Gourmet magazine. Hi, guys.
Hey, Lynn.
Hi, Lynn.
Guys, do you think great Jewish deli can exist outside of New York City?
Without any doubt, the answer is yes. Shapiro's in Indianapolis, Manny's Cafeteria in Chicago, and DZ Aiken's in San Diego are all examples of absolutely top-notch kosher-style delis that serve some of the best Jewish food you can get anywhere, including the Lower East Side of New York City.
Hmm.
You may be skeptical, but here's the test to take. Order some rye bread. In fact, Jane and I have been very concerned lately. There is a rye bread crisis in New York City. When you go to Katz's Deli downtown, the Carnegie Midtown, you get excellent pastrami, corned beef, brisket. The bread that they put it on is not what it ought to be. You want that rye bread with the real good sour crust, the caraway seeds in it, the real kind of chewy, muscular rye bread that will sustain, you know, a half-pound sandwich. We haven't gotten that lately in New York. We did get it at DZ Aiken's in San Diego.
Now, this is San Diego. I mean, what does San Diego know about this kind of deli?
Yeah, I know what you're saying, Lynn. I mean, you know, don't forget, I grew up in New York City. And I'm a Jew, so therefore I'm an expert on, you know, on all things. On everything.
Yeah.
Right? And to me, you know, where there's sun, there should be no deli, you know, and San Diego being, you know, this wonderful, you know, beachy, surfy area.
Right, exactly.
It's antithetical. I mean, it's just like, how can you eat a half pound of pastrami and then go sit in the sun? I mean, you would just die. But in fact, that's not true. And I do have to say that probably the best homemade blintzes, which is one of my top 10 all-time favorite things, and matzah brie, which nobody makes very palatable matzah brie except Michael at home, had the best versions of those two things at DZ Aiken's that I have had in years.
You know, I think you ought to explain what matzah brie is.
Well, oftentimes you see matzah brie described as a matzah omelet, meaning, you know, matzahs, the unleavened crackers, are
right,
broken up and put into eggs. To me, that's going in the entirely wrong direction, meaning when you describe it as an omelet, there's too much egg to matzah. To me, it is matzah kind of gently coated in egg so that it has a consistency that is vaguely related to French toast. It's eggy matzah that is fried in massive amounts of butter. And the butter is absorbed into the matzah. And you serve it with either sour cream or applesauce, or possibly both. And it's really one of the great kind of Jewish soul food breakfasts, lunches, dinners, or midnight snacks.
Okay, well, now tell me about this deli. What is it like?
It's huge.
It's an entire shopping center.
Yeah.
It's multiple rooms. There's an entire soda fountain in one part of it. It goes against all rules of what you would expect a cozy Jewish deli to be like. There are tables, there are booths, there is a long counter, there's a place to get ice cream floats. There's an entire menu of ice cream. There are 8 kinds of homemade soup every single day. It's kind of inexplicable how huge it is, and yet it seems to be thriving.
And what really annoys me is that Michael's mother and father retired to San Diego 20 years ago, mm-hmm. and we just found this place 2 weeks ago. I mean, we could have been eating blintzes and matzo brei for 20 years, but no, we were eating fish tacos.
Well, thank you, guys. Okay, I'm going to have to ponder this.
Believe us. It's true.
It's true. It's all true.
Okay, bye.
Stick shifts and safety belts, bucket seats have all got to go when we're driving in the car. It makes my baby seem so far. I need you here with me, not way over in a bucket seat. I need you to be here with me, not way over in a bucket seat.
Gene and Michael Stern are the authors of the updated classic guide, Road Food. You can tune into the Sterns right here every week, but you can get their food finds anytime. Just go to the website, splendidtable.org. And while you're on the site, go whole hog. Sign up for our weekly e-newsletter. It's called Weeknight Kitchen, and every week you get a quick worknight supper recipe. This week it's garlic ribeye steaks. And this is one of those recipes that gives you great mileage. You can use it for lamb chops and chicken and pork. Anyway, we always throw in some shopping and technique tips, but best of all, Weeknight Kitchen is free. So sign up at splendidtable.org. When the low-carb diets waltzed in one door, pasta was banished out the other. This qualified as a major loss. The nutritionist said, eat whole grain pasta. You'll never know the difference. I said, is your taste in your feet? Well, evidently, there has been a paradigm shift on the pasta front. Now, this is according to a woman I trust, New York Times columnist Marion Burroughs. She has taste-tested 45 whole grain pastas and has a report. Marion, it's good to have you back.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Okay, now several years ago, you know, back when I was sampling this stuff, soaked cardboard best described most whole grain pastas. But you say there's this new generation. So what have you found?
Oh, there's a sea change. It's unbelievable how it's changed. And I learned sort of accidentally. But what's happened is they've learned how to do it better. They learned how to manufacture it better. And so now it does not taste like grain that has not been processed. It doesn't taste like cardboard. It's not brittle. It slides down as effortlessly and as deliciously as refined pasta does, made with white flour.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an enormous advance.
So tell me specifics. What did you find? Which brands did you like?
Well, I found overall that flat pastas, you know, angel hair, spaghetti, spaghettini, fettuccine, cappellini, etc., are the very best in terms of texture. Very few of what you're called the extruded pastas, elbows and shaped things like
mm-hmm.
that,
mm-hmm.
are as good. They still have a little bit of the, they don't bend, they break taste
yeah.
to them.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you have to be much more careful about what you choose there. And just before, I want to be sure and get this in, because when we get to the end and I haven't said it, I'll be sorry. Somebody wrote me about a pasta. They were so sorry they hadn't gotten to me to taste. And it's made by a company called Latini, and it's made with farro, which is a relative of wheat. And it is just delicious. And I don't know exactly where it's available in the United States, but I know that it is available because they are having events to announce its arrival, so to speak. So I would look for that along with from flat whole wheat pastas, the Bio Natura, an Italian import, DiCecco, also an Italian import. Pasta Riscosa is good. West Bray Organic is pretty good, too. La Terra il Cielo, as a capellini, was very good. And even Annie's Organic spaghetti was pretty good, not as good as some of the others. I can't tell you that I liked any of the whole grain pastas made with brown rice or spelt or all the other things that they have tried. Although buckwheat soba, which has been around for a very long time.
Yeah, it's Japanese.
Because the Japanese has always been very good. Among the shaped pastas, again, I would go with the Bio Natura fusilli. By the way, it's organic. Hodgson Mill elbows have a good texture. And this La Tierra il Cielo of Faro Penne, it's among the better ones. I have no recommendations when it comes to other extruded pastas.
Right.
I don't think they're very good. And you can, at first I thought, well, you know, if you put a really strong marinara or bolognese sauce on it, any pasta, you could eat any pasta with this stuff. But then I started experimenting with much more delicate pasta sauces and found that any of them work perfectly. And this is the killer reason that I know that everybody's going to like this stuff. My partner doesn't like anything. He basically likes, you know, steak and potatoes.
Right.
And he'll have some pasta. Well, I have been giving him whole wheat pasta with whatever sauces I'm making for the last year and a half, and he eats them all up and makes no comment about the texture of the pasta. This means, believe me, it sounds a little backwards, but, you know, this means it's really good.
But these are the tests that really make a difference in life.
Depends on who you're feeding, right?
Exactly. Marion, you have opened up a new world for certain people like
me.
Oh,
I hope so.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
New York Times columnist Marion Burroughs' article on whole grain pastas appeared in the May 18th, 2005 issue of the paper. Marion is author of 20-minute menus. Now, she left us with her recipe for whole wheat linguine with red clam sauce. Find it on the website, guys. SplendidTable.org. Now, the pasta that hadn't gotten into the article, the one made of farro flour by the Latini company. Well, Latini is a pioneer in Italy's latest pasta trend. Wheat-specific pastas made from a single type, usually an heirloom grain. The Latinis chose one called Senatore Capelli. It's nearly extinct. In fact, it hasn't been grown since the 1950s. They call the pasta Senatore, and they apply all the techniques which separate artisan from commercial. You know, long kneading, textured bronze dyes, slow drying. Now, I love this. Along with wine, coffee beans, produce, chocolate, pasta joins the backlash. It seems the more massive and mediocre mass production becomes, the more individual and hands-on products appear. Keep it coming, guys. Coming up, running a cooking school in France and putting frozen pizza to the test. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media.
Thank you.
I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show about life's appetites. Our show is brought to you by Super Target, one-stop shopping for groceries, cookware, and entertaining. You can find them online at target.com/supertarget. Expert Susan Herman Loomis has covered the waterfront. 20 years ago, she took herself to Paris to apprentice and ended up running a cafe there. She came home to write on American, Italian, and seafood. She's done books and articles for all the major food outlets. Then Susan realized the dream career, at least from the outside looking in. She took her family to live in a small French town and opened a cooking school. Her memoir about her life there was En Rue Tatin. Now she's followed it up with Cooking at Home en Rue Tatin. Hey, Susan, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks, Lynn. It's great to be here.
Now, I'm thinking you've opened a cooking school, but you're not in Paris. You're not in Provence. How did you come to this small town? You're in Normandy, right? In northwestern France, essentially.
That's right. We're an hour northwest of Paris. And the choice was actually easy because we wanted to be near Paris, and we have good friends who live not far away, and we're near the coastline. So for me, those are the criteria I needed for the perfect place.
Mm-hmm. Now, people fantasize about setting up a cooking school in places like France. It looks like, as I said in the introduction, the dream job. But there's a real world side to this, I know. This is what I think you should do. Tell us about a typical week of running a cooking school in France.
Well, a typical week, the actual week of school is a dream. So, we start the week on a Sunday night where I cook dinner for the guests who come, and I take small groups because I want the experience to be intimate. So There are never more than 8 people, and we have dinner together on Sunday night. And then Monday, we get right into the trenches. I hand out aprons. We start cooking. And we cook lunch and dinner that day. And it's hands-on cooking, and all the menus are geared to the home cook. Mm-hmm. And each recipe highlights a technique of some sort so that by the end of the week, everybody's cooked through many, many basic French techniques, and they walk away with this knowledge. Monday night, we do a goat cheese tasting, and I have a goat cheese maker come in and talk to us. Tuesday, we have a special bread class where we make the typical pain au levain that is so wonderful. Wednesday, we all get up early and go to a market, a very old-fashioned market, and we buy a picnic lunch and come home and have that at home. And then Wednesday night, we do the most amazing wine tasting with a caviste who comes in from Honfleur, which is a town nearby. And Thursday, we're out all day visiting artisans and eating in restaurants and just kind of getting out to see. I'm trying to show people the way the French are passionate about what they do. So we visit these passionate artisans. And then Friday, we cook our final farewell meal and we all sob as the week is over.
But what goes into organizing this kind of thing?
Well, it's huge. First of all, what we did, my husband built the teaching kitchen that I teach out of. It's our home kitchen. So there was that whole thing, and that was a very long project. And then as I'm planning a class, I first of all test all the recipes many times to be sure they work, and I put together the menus for each week, and they change each week depending on what's available, what's seasonal. And also, when I'm doing classes in a row, I want to be sure I'm not getting sort of blasé about the recipes. So I have to change them for that reason too. And I try to leave room to fit in the recipe that inevitably I haven't thought to add that everyone is there to learn. Oh, aren't we going to learn a beurre blanc? Or can you show me how to make crepe? Or, I've got to leave room for that kind of thing too.
How many weeks a year do you teach?
I teach 10 weeks a year in the spring and the fall.
Do people actually stay with you?
No, they stay in a hotel nearby. Our house isn't really that big. And, I need time off, too. I have 2 small children. And And so they stay and they walk back and forth to classes, which is really great because you walk through the town. So you get to know the town also.
Yeah, yeah. And
I would say it's a very intense experience for everybody. I think people look at the schedule before they come and they think there won't be enough cooking. And then by the time the week's over, they just say, you know, it was a perfect balance because I want them to cook and I want to be sure they meet French people and sit down to eat with French people. So that they really get an insider's look at the whole country.
Do you think cooking classes are becoming more popular?
Definitely. Absolutely. I think people, they've traveled a lot. They want to go a level deeper into a country. And one way to do that is through a cooking class. And so many people who travel to France are food people.
Mm-hmm. You know, on the financial side, I mean, do you think...
Oh, no.
I mean, the real world, though, is you're a professional. You make a living doing what you do. Do you think you can make a cooking school pay if you don't have your name out there as you do as a writer, or if you're in the United States, for instance, you don't have a shop connected to it?
You can if you're willing to devote your entire life to, you know, to your classes and to marketing yourself. And I would say that is the toughest part. You know, if I only had a cooking school and didn't have a family, I would need to be on the road, even with my name out there, on the road, marketing all the time. And that's, you know, that is the part of it that you sort of don't think of until you're into it and you realize you just have to keep your name out there. I think for people who don't write books or don't have a store, it would be very difficult to make it work.
Yeah. You know, one of the things that you talk about in the book, too, is how over the years you have seen the sensibilities, the culinary sensibilities change in rural France. What's been happening?
I think what's happened is that the ethnicity of French food has changed dramatically. You know, France went out and colonized the world, and the colonies are coming back to France through food. So that now it's very typical to have tamarind in a soup or cilantro in a salad. You know, the turmeric is a really common seasoning. Curry is something that shows up all the time. Couscous. You cannot write about French food today without talking about couscous. And I think that's something that if you're just visiting France, you don't really get that right away. And as I'm living there, I feel like I'm in the midst of a phenomenon because I now realize that when I walk through my town, I smell so many different ethnic aromas along with boeuf bourguignon and coq au vin and things that are very traditional.
Fascinating time to be over there, Susan. Hey, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Susan Herman-Loomis is author of Cooking at Home on Rue Tatin. Now, you can get information on Susan's cooking school and her recipe for an unusual summer starter, melon and lime parfait. It's on the website, splendidtable.org.
I am hungry.
A prime example of a gloriously obsessed, mouthy lover of all things edible is Ed Levine. Now, he can uncover the most obscure ethnic specialty in its native New York neighborhood in a nanosecond. And he will go anywhere and he will taste forever to come up with what he considers to be the paragon of quality. Now, this is just what he's done for his book, Pizza, A Slice of Heaven, The Ultimate Guide and Companion. Ed, welcome.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Lynn.
Now, you know, Ed, you think pizza, we are talking a world here. What did it take to do this book?
It was an insane moment when I decided to do this book because even I hadn't fully considered the ramifications of trying to do a comprehensive book on pizza. And then when I decided, okay, well, I do. How could I write a book about pizza without going to Italy? And so then I, you know, decided I had to go to Naples. Mm-hmm. And, you know, basically what happened was I spent a year eating what I now estimate was 1,000 slices of pizza.
You ate pizza all over the United States, and then you went to Naples.
Exactly. It was crazy. It was crazy, but it was a fine madness. I mean, it was really fun.
Well, now, I mean, this is a very personal subject for so many people. Have you had, the usual flood of letters saying, how could you not have included?
Absolutely. From every part of the country, I have been excoriated and criticized. And, in Chicago, I'm persona non grata. I have to wear a Kevlar vest when I land at O'Hare because I said that at best, Chicago deep dish pizza is a good casserole. And that just sent them into an apoplectic rage. A columnist in the Chicago Sun-Times, Mark Brown, a really lovely guy, he devoted two columns to my pronouncements about Chicago pizza. They're not even in the food section.
You're not going to please all of the people all of the time. This is the real world. But speaking of the real world, what I loved in the book, among other things, is you did a tasting critique of frozen pizzas. And this is what I think most people end up eating. We're not going to stop at the great pizzeria, mm-hmm. even if I have one.
Yeah,
every night to bring home dinner.
It's true. And frozen pizza, especially outside New York, where there is literally a pizzeria on every corner, outside New York, a lot of people eat frozen pizza probably more often than they eat at their local Pizza Hut or Domino's.
Well, now tell me, which ones did you taste and what did you find?
Well, we tasted the Whole Foods brand. Mm-hmm. We tasted DiGiorno. We tasted, I don't know how to pronounce this, Freschetta or Freschetta.
Right, I think it's Freschetta.
And we tasted American flatbread from Waitsfield, Vermont. Mm-hmm. And then we tasted, I think, Amy's, which is an organic pizza. And we also tasted California Pizza Kitchen's frozen pizza. And I have to say, and I was inspired to do this because I read, there was a piece in the New York Times by a guy named Brendan Kerner in the business section, in which he talked about all the new techniques and technologies that have gone into improving frozen pizza, all the rising crust stuff. So I was going, maybe I've just been neglecting something great all these years. So I decided, okay, well, I'm going to taste all the frozen pizzas I can find. And I also enlisted the aid of my friend and colleague, Jeffrey Steingarten, who actually, although he's a little loftier than me in terms of his food ideals, actually loves pizza more than life itself. So he and I tasted all the pizzas. We heated the pizza stones. We did everything we were supposed to do. And what we found was most of them still tasted like Cheetos. They tasted like cheese crackers, or they tasted like, at best, they tasted like cheesy bread. And that even the best one was Vermont flatbread, American flatbread, which is made in Vermont.
Right.
And the only problem with that is because they're in Vermont and they may be old hippies, they felt the need to add maple syrup into the crust.
Oh.
What's that all about? But it was pretty good. But the rising crust pizzas and all that stuff, they were rough going.
Oh, this is very depressing. Yeah. What about, national chains. Were there any there that you liked?
Well, what's weird is there's a chain that started outside Boston called Bertucci's, where they actually, at least in the beginning, were using only wood-fired ovens and were using fresh mozzarella. And I have to say, and I went to two or three Bertucci's for the book, one in mm-hmm. Washington, D.C., one in Jersey City, which is the closest that it's gotten to New York City. And I was pretty impressed. The pizza was really, really good. And if you were in a town where Bertucci's was the best pizza that the town had to offer, you'd be in pretty good shape. It was a quantum leap above the Domino's and the Pizza Huts and the Little Caesars of the world. But those places are all about value And they're all about how much cheese can I deliver on a piece of warm bread for how much money? Right? I mean, yeah. Because stuffed crust pizza is a really vile invention. You can't put enough cheese on something in this country.
That's right. I mean, we like this. Hey, yeah. Ed, thank you for the insights.
Oh, my pleasure, Lynn.
Ed Levine's pizza magnum opus is Pizza, A Slice of Heaven, the Ultimate Guide and Companion.
If you're feeling sad and lonely, there's a service I can render. Tell the one who loves you only, I can be so warm and tender. Call me, don't be afraid, you can call me. Maybe it's late, but just call.
The lines are officially open, and you can reach us at 800-537-5252, and we will talk. Okay, let's see. Who is up? We have got Pam calling from Miami. Hey, Pam, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I just bought a new cookbook, and I came across an ingredient that I haven't seen before.
And what is it?
It's spelled C-O-R-N-I-C-H-O-N.
It's a pickle. It's called cornichon.
Oh, my gosh.
How is it used in the recipe?
Well, it was used in two vegetable recipes, one for artichoke and the other one was asparagus. One of them was a salad.
So you've not met up with a cornichon gather?
No, I haven't.
They're not on every street corner, you know, but this is the French entry to the sour pickle world. And they're little. Mm-hmm. They're really little. I mean, they're like 3 inches, maybe. And they're a pickle that's done with white wine vinegar and tarragon, mustard seed, and onion. There may be some garlic in there, but they're really sour and crunchy. And they have a tarragon undertone. And one of the classic ways they're served is with things like pâtés, you know, rich meats.
Okay.
You know, it's that old idea that something very acidic served with something that's kind of fatty cuts it.
Mm-hmm.
And it always tastes good. And they tend to be, what annoys me is, I mean, a cornichon is a pickle. and it's always expensive. I mean, little jars can be like $6. And I think depending, I mean, if it's an ingredient in a dish that has a lot of other ingredients in it, you may want to think about substituting a sour pickle, preferably not one that tastes a lot of dill. But, you know, if it's crunchy and it's a sour pickle, it's probably going to be just swell in that dish. And if you want to have some fun, then you can, you know, go to a specialty shop and get cornichon. You live in Miami, right?
I live in Miami, yeah.
You should be able to find it. I just resent parting with the dollars.
I know what you mean, because I went looking for marjoram last night and I was in shock.
Yeah. And the other, one of my other favorite things is arugula sold, you know, 3 branches to the box for $2 or $3. And it's like, no, guys, this is sold in bunches. It's called a salad. But that's another issue entirely. Hey, Pam, thank you. And, you know, sour pickles, they'll work.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You are welcome. Bye.
Bye.
Well, it's time for our weekly trivia challenge. Now, the question is, what is the most popular drink in Italy after Campari? And we're going to have that answer in a moment, and we're going to be taking more of your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper, and this is The Splendid Table, the show for people who love to eat. The Splendid Table is brought to you by Super Target. It's Target, now available in food, where you can find the expected and unexpected aisle after aisle. Online at target.com/Super Target. Now, we're going to be getting back to your calls in a moment. The number is 800-537-5252. But first, I've got the answer to this week's trivia challenge. Now, the question was, what is the most popular drink in Italy after Campari? Well, it's limoncello. Now, this is a lemon-on-lemon kind of experience. It's a liqueur made from fresh lemons. It's a specialty of the South. It's made in places like Capri and Sicily. You can keep it in the freezer, and you can drink it straight. You can put it in spritzers. You can pour it over fruit and ice cream. You can do desserts with it. Now, we have had a ton of emails asking for a recipe. Now, one basic formula, and trust me, there are a ton of them, but anyway, one basic formula is one bottle of 100 proof alcohol, I use vodka, the peel of 10 to 12 fragrant lemons, and then you need some time, like a week or more. You let that just sit together. Then you cook up, boil together to make a syrup, 2 cups water, 2 cups sugar, all right? You cool that down, you mix it with the lemon blend, and you age it another week or many months. And then you've got a drink. Now, you can dilute it, you can sweeten it up. But the real fun here is that limoncello is one of hundreds of homemade drinks. I mean, basically, they are all the same. You have high-proof alcohol, brandy, grappa, vodka, and then for every quart of that, you want 2 cups of sugar and some strong flavorings. For instance, to make the Provence classic, ratafia, you add the zest and juice of 6 oranges, some coriander seed, and you let that sit in a dark place from 2 weeks to 6 months. Now, if you take that blend and you pour 4 big bottles of spicy ginger ale into it, you've got a summer party punch. Okay, let's get back to the phones. The number is 800-537-5252. Let's see, who has been waiting patiently? We have got Chris calling from Minneapolis. Hey, Chris, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. Thanks so much. I am calling because I have a new issue with cooking for my family. I've got a 14-year-old son who has been a vegetarian for about 4 months.
Uh-huh.
And I am very happy to experiment. I have a couple of the Moosewood cookbooks. But I'm kind of hearing rumblings from the other family members who are dedicated carnivores. And so I'm just looking for resources or cookbooks that might help be creative and make everybody happy.
You mean something that can be crossover food as opposed to tofu with everything?
You got it. No tofu.
There's a couple of things to consider. I mean, one way when people talk about gradually becoming vegetarian, one of the things is make the vegetable dishes even more interesting with the way you season them or the variety of them and pull back on the meat, until finally there's very little meat on the platter. And I mean, one of the things right there would be if you do anything with beans, anything with whole grains, you've given him a complete protein and it'll be delicious and the family's going to love it, but they can also be, the grilled piece of meat on the plate as well for the rest of the family.
Right.
And I mean, if you do a green salad, you take a couple of cans of chickpeas and you saute them, or you saute garlic and onion, with a little chili, you throw in the chickpeas, you add, some tomato and you cook that down to almost nothing. You serve that with something like brown rice or bulgur wheat. It is so good. A big green salad with everything in it you can imagine. And then, you have the meat or the fish.
Yeah, that sounds really good.
And somebody, by the way, who is, I think, one of the great crossover vegetarian food writers, because she eats meat, but her books are mainly vegetarian, but the food is fabulous, is Deborah Madison.
Oh, okay, yeah. I've heard of her, but I have never looked at any of her books.
She has one book called Vegetarian Cooking for Everyone that is dynamite.
Oh, great.
Her latest one is, I think it's Vegetarian Suppers from Deborah Madison's Kitchen. And her food is so good. First of all, for the rest of the family, you'll never miss the meat. But it's very much European, some Asian-based. You don't feel like somebody's remade a dish and compromised it just to make it vegetarian.
Right, because I feel like that's kind of what I've been doing.
And that's my complaint about a lot of vegetarian food.
Yeah.
The other thing is, go to cultures where it's a great tradition. India, 3,000 years of eating without meat.
Mm-hmm.
Fabulous, fabulous food. Most of Asia, same kind of thing. So there's three ways to go. Deborah Madison, you know, adjusting that the meat goes on the platter, but what's there is great all by itself. And then think about the cultures that already are vegetarian or have large vegetarian populations.
Right. Take some cooking classes.
Oh, yeah. That never hurts. And you can have fun. Hey, Chris, thanks.
Thanks, Lynn.
You enjoy. Bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You can reach us at 800-537-5252. It's not as hard as it seems. And I know how tricky it gets when you're going through the conversion and it's one person in the family and everybody else is saying, where is the steak? Just spike up the veggie dishes a little. Let's see, who's up next? We have got Chanel calling from Durham, North Carolina. Hi, Chanel, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, I had a question about nasturtium flowers. I had read somewhere that they are edible, and I am looking for some for my garden, and I was just wondering how to do that from windowsill to plate, I guess.
Well, first of all, I should tell you, because I am the black thumb of all time, except with herbs, if you put them in sandy soil and a lot of sun, they grow like weeds, and they're beautiful. And mine go all summer, and they're gorgeous. Yes, they are edible. Their leaves are edible. The leaves taste peppery.
Okay.
Wonderful in salad. And the flowers are peppery as well. You take away the green, you know, at the base of the flower, that green little pod?
Right.
That
yes.
You cut away.
Okay.
But, I mean, first of all, a garnish on a plate. Incredible. Secondly, take something like maybe cream cheese, mascarpone, you know, a fresh cheese. Chop up the flowers, scallion, and the leaves, and a little salt and pepper and a tad of olive oil. Mix that in with the cheese, and then spread it on anything that doesn't move too fast, on cucumber slices, for instance. And then put a nasturtium flower on top of it. It's a fabulous cheese.
Wow. Okay, so it tastes okay then. I was wondering if it was bitter or...
No. Sometimes that little bulb behind the flower can have a little bit more punch to it, but it tends to be peppery, tends to be really tasty, beautiful in a tossed green salad.
Wow.
Beautiful. And in fact, you know, if you mix something like chive flowers or violets, I'm assuming none of this stuff is sprayed, you know, that's the whole deal.
No.
Rose petals. I mean, think of what you could do with tender spring greens or, you know, early summer greens.
Right.
I mean, you could make a salad that people will plots. So really grow them and eat them. They're fabulous.
Okay.
Oh, and you know what the other thing is? You can fry them like zucchini flowers.
Okay, so fried, lightly fried.
I mean, dip in a little bit of egg or milk and roll in seasoned flour and drop, you know, just have like a half inch of olive oil in the pan or oil and just, you know, crisp fry them. And you eat them like candy.
Oh, wow, that sounds great.
Well, oh, you're going to have a blast with them. And they look great. I mean, they just look so happy. They're dummies can grow them. You're not a dummy, but I'm a dummy.
Oh no, I will admit I'm a dummy. I'm still looking for them, and I've been told that it's a little late in the season to find them. But
I've started them from seed, and I, you're where? And you're in Durham, right?
Durham, right? So I don't need to start it from seed, but I would like to find some somewhere. And
they grow pretty quickly.
Okay.
Yeah, they do grow pretty fast. So enjoy.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
You take care. Enjoy those flowers.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye.
This whole idea, nasturtiums, oh, guys, they're fabulous. I mean, they're beautiful. They come in all these colors. They just make you smile. Okay, who's up next? You can reach us, by the way, 800-537-5252. We have Richard calling from Winchester, Kentucky. Hey, Richard, what do you want to talk about?
Hi. Say, my wife asked me to call. She grew up in central Pennsylvania.
Uh-huh.
She had a Sicilian godmother that served a dish that she just loved, and she's having problems replicating it. It's breaded fried red tomatoes.
Ooh.
And she used this as a side dish or a light lunch over toast. she indicates that they were good garden tomatoes rather than the cardboard store-bought ones.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Breaded with some kind of lightly seasoned breadcrumbs and fried. And when they were done, while the tomatoes were still in the pan, she'd put in about a cup of milk to make a reduction-type gravy.
Ooh.
Now, she's been trying to replicate this and has had a few problems. And she's just been wondering if anybody had recipes or curious if anyone had heard about this fabulous dish.
You know, I've never heard of it, and I'm not saying I know everything there is to know about anything, especially Sicilian food. I've spent some time in Sicily, you know, and done research, but this is, there'll be two people making a dish like this in the world, and it'll be so fabulous. Uh-huh. And it may well be a specialty of where she came from. But when you say frying red tomatoes, the one thing that comes to mind is they're so juicy and they tend to be so soft that if you don't flash fry them, you're going to get mush. You might get mush anyway. Is this one of the problems she's having?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay, this is what I would do. Slightly underripe tomatoes. You want them to be firm. Now, they should be good tomatoes because you really want flavor. But you don't want to use them full ripe because they're just going to go to mush. So that's number one. They should be pretty firm. The other thing is make sure that the oil is pretty hot. Now, I just wonder if she used lard because there's a lot of lard frying in southern Italy. A lot of people couldn't afford olive oil, believe it or not. They sold it, you know, for money. But one way or the other, the fat should be pretty hot. And I'd use, you know, you could use a little thermometer to find out, but about 375. I mean, if you drop a piece of bread in it, it should turn golden in several seconds. So I would do like a flash fry of it in about a half inch of oil, or if you can get really good homemade lard, and then pour off almost all of that. Oh, the breadcrumbs. I think the breadcrumbs ideally should be fresh breadcrumbs that you make in the food processor, you know, with a baguette or even you could use store bread. It doesn't matter. But I would throw into it some dry oregano and basil and salt and pepper.
Okay.
It couldn't hurt. Let's put it that way. And then what I would do is once they're out of the pan and you pour off and leave just a very thin film of the oil or be a little more generous than that. I would add a little chopped garlic to that, warm it up, and then add the milk and boil it down. Or maybe even a little half and half.
Sounds good.
See, ask her to try that, but the firmer tomatoes may be one of the secrets. And really flash frying, making sure your fat, not smoking hot, but it's got to be hot, and you go in and out, and you drain on paper towels, and you serve it right away.
Very good.
And keep that heat high when you get the milk in there. Just sure. Boil it like crazy.
All right.
And you made me very hungry. Thanks, Richard.
Thank you.
Goodbye. Bye. Call us, guys. 800-537-5252. I put state parks high on the tally of the worst places to eat. They're right up there with hospitals and schools. I mean, think about this. You're in some gorgeous setting, eager for local specialties, and it's cheese whiz nachos from the microwave. Well, Kentucky chef Bob Perry is trying to change all this. He has become director of food service and the Commonwealth executive chef for the Kentucky Department of Parks. Bob Perry, thanks for talking with us.
Hi, Lance. Good to be here.
Bob, explain to me exactly what you're doing.
Well, I took over as director of food service when the new Fletcher administration came in about a year and a half ago.
Mm-hmm.
And like you, I've traveled to a lot of state parks over the years, and I just always thought it could be better than it was. And when I started, I asked about buying local produce directly from the farmers.
Right.
And was told we can't do it.
Why not?
That's the same question I asked.
Yeah.
And I kept asking that question. And working very closely with the Kentucky Department of Agriculture and the Finance Cabinet and the Commerce Cabinet, we were able to work out a plan where we could buy directly from the farmers. And so far, it's gone rather well.
Now, Bob, you're talking about the restaurants in the state parks and state facilities, right?
Yes. Kentucky has the largest number of resort parks in the nation. We have 17 resort parks with restaurants. We have 3 employee cafes here in Frankfort. And we also operate the cafe at the Kentucky Artisan Center in Berea. So these are all full-service restaurants.
Now, what kinds of specific dishes are you serving with local ingredients?
Well, the first thing, of course, we got this spring was lettuces, and we have been using them both in our salad bars and as individual salads. And something else we got early on that Kentucky is somewhat known for is fresh asparagus. And, of course, with fresh asparagus, all you have to do is steam it. Don't really have to do anything else to it.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly.
And
right.
We serve as a great middle market for those growers that are already big enough that are selling to co-ops or to larger wholesalers. We offer an additional market. And for those growers looking to get into growing produce, we offer a very stable market for them. Of course, Kentucky is a big tobacco state.
Right.
Since all that has changed, our farmers are looking for new crops and new markets.
And you can be a prime one for them.
Exactly. And one of the big questions and big problems we heard through our friends in the Department of Agriculture and the Extension Office at University of Kentucky was even when farmers sell directly to private restaurants, they always seem to have a problem getting paid. We worked out a system where if they sign up for direct deposit, the state will pay them within 3 days.
That's a great turnaround. Now, would you have some advice for other states that would like to try to implement this program?
I think one of the big things that we did, the other large question that always came up in our discussions was, what should the farmers charge and what should we pay?
Mm-hmm.
And when you're dealing in a government environment, of course, you're dealing with taxpayer money. So you have to safeguard that money the best you can. What we worked out is we get a weekly hot sheet from our regular wholesale suppliers, produce companies, and big wholesalers. We compile a price list every week of produce prices that we would normally pay from those regular sources.
Mm-hmm.
And we publish that. We have it available at the parks. And that's the price that we are willing to pay the growers for the produce that they bring us. In this way, we're not paying any more than we would from our normal wholesale suppliers, so we're not costing our taxpayers any money. And the UK Extension Service did a study on tomato prices last year and found that the price we were offering was only slightly below farmers market prices and way above co-op and wholesale prices.
So the farmer sees those published prices and the farmer decides if they want to sell to you.
Correct.
Uh-huh. Is there any chance sometime down the line I'm going to be able to come to one of the park facilities and have some of that great Kentucky ham or bacon?
Yes. As a matter of fact, at General Butler, we have already changed the concept to a bistro menu, and one of the most popular dishes right now is a center-cut T-bone pork chop that's from Happy Hollow Farms out of Springfield, Kentucky.
Mm. I can't imagine going to a park in Kentucky and not getting country ham.
We always have country ham at parks. We have to.
Hey, Bob, thank you.
Thank you, Lynn.
Chef Bob Perry is Director of Food Service and the Commonwealth Executive Chef for the Kentucky Department of Parks. Well, that's the show for this week. Thanks for joining us. Remember, you can call us anytime. Number's 800-537-5252. And until next week, let me leave you with this quote from an anonymous source. Anonymous said, "In this uncertain world, the food is disposable. It's the wrappers that are permanent." The Splendid Table is produced by American Public Media and brought to you by SuperTarget. Everything you heard here today and so much more can be found on our website, splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen. It's our attempt to simplify your kitchen life midweek. You register for it online, splendidtable.org. Our producer is Sally Swift with Jennifer Russell. Our technical director is Jennifer Lubke. Our website is managed by Judy Graham and Julia Schrankler. Have a great week. Be sure to join us next time. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper.
American Public Media.